some lady's cat when it was someone else, Deputy Rob McGee, for instance, who actually risked a broken collarbone by going up the tree where Mistress Pussycat was and bringing her down. McGee listened to Marjorie Dederick babble for maybe 2 minutes, then cut her off with 4 or 5 questions, quick and curt, like a trained fighter's flicking little jabs to the face, the kind of punches that are so small and so hard that the blood comes before the sting. When he had answers to these, he said, "I'll call Bobo Marchand. He's got dogs. You stay put, Miss Dederick. If your man and your boy come back, make them stay put, too. Try, anyway." Her man and her boy had, meanwhile, followed the track of the abductor 3 miles to the northwest. But when his trail ran out of open fields and into piney woods, they lost it. They were farmers, not hunters, as I have said, and by then they knew it was an animal they were after. Along the way, they had found the yellow top that matched Kathy's shorts and another piece of Cora's nightie. Both items were drenched with blood, and neither Klaus nor Howie was in as much of a hurry as they had been at the start. A certain cold certainty must have been filtering into their hot hopes by then, working its way downward the way cold water does, sinking because it is heavier. They cast into the woods, looking for signs, found none. Cast in a second place, with similar lack of result. Then in a third. This time they found a fantail of blood splashed across the needles of a loblolly pine. They went in the direction it seemed to point for a little way, then began the casting about process again. It was, by then, 9 o'clock in the morning, and from behind them they began to hear shouting men and baying dogs. Rob McGee had put together a jackleg posse in the time it would have taken Sheriff Kribus to finish his first brandy-sweetened cup of coffee, and by 4:15 the hour they reached Klaus and Howie Dederick, the two of them stumbling desperately around on the edge of the woods. Soon the men were moving again, with Bobo's dogs leading the way. McGee let Klaus and Howie go on with them. They wouldn't have gone back if he'd ordered them, no matter how much they dreaded the outcome, and McGee must have seen that. But he made them unload their weapons. The others had done the same, McGee said. It was safer. What he didn't tell them, nor did anyone else, was that the Dettericks were the only ones who had been asked to turn their loads over to the deputy. Half distracted and wanting only to go through to the end of the nightmare and be done with it, they did as he asked. When Rob McGee got the Dettericks to unload their guns and give him their loads, he probably saved John Coffey's miserable excuse for a life. The baying, yawping dogs pulled them through 2 miles of scrub pine, always on that same rough northwest heading. Then they came out on the edge of the Trepingus River, which is wide and slow at that point, running southeast through low wooded hills where families named Cray and Robinette and Duplessis still made their own mandolins and often spat out their own rotted teeth as they plowed. Deep countryside where men were apt to handle snakes on Sunday morning and lie down in carnal embrace with their daughters on Sunday night. I knew their families. Most of them had sent Sparky a meal from time to time. On the far side of the river, the members of the posse could see the June sun glinting off the steel rails of a great southern branch line. About a mile downstream to their right, a trestle crossed toward the coal fields of West Green. Here they found a wide, trampled patch in the grass and low bushes, a patch so bloody that many of the men had to sprint back into the woods and relieve themselves of their breakfasts. They also found the rest of Cora's nightgown lying in this bloody patch, and Howie, who had held up admirably until then, reeled back against his father and nearly fainted. And it was here that Bobo Marchant's dogs had their first and only disagreement of the day. There were 6 in all. 2 bloodhounds, 2 blue tick hounds, and a couple of those terrier-like mongrels border southerners call coonhounds. The coonies wanted to go northwest, upstream along the Trepingus. The rest wanted to go in the other direction, southeast. They got all tangled in their leads, and although the papers said nothing about this part, I could imagine the horrible curses Bobo must have rained down on them as he used his hands, surely the most educated part of him, to get them straightened around again. I've known a few hound dog men in my time, and it's been my experience that as a class they run remarkably true to type. Bobo short-leashed them into a pack, then ran Cora Dederick's torn nightgown under their noses to kind of remind them what they were doing out on a day when the temperature would be in the mid-90s by noon and the no-see-ums were already circling the heads of the posse men in clouds. The coonies took another sniff, decided to vote the straight ticket, and off they all went downstream in full cry. It wasn't but 10 minutes later when the men stopped, realizing they could hear more than just the dogs. It was a howling rather than a baying, and a sound no dog had ever made, not even in its dying extremities. It was a sound none of them had ever heard anything make, but they knew right away, all of them, that it was a man. So they said, and I believed them. I think I would have recognized it, too. I have heard men scream just that way, I think, on their way to the electric chair. Not a lot. Most button themselves up and go either quiet or joking, like it was the class picnic. But a few, usually the ones who believe in hell as a real place and know it is waiting for them at the end of the green mile. Bobo short-leashed his dogs again. They were valuable, and he had no intention of losing them to the psychopath howling and gibbering just down yonder. The other men reloaded their guns and snapped them closed. That howling had chilled them all and made the sweat under their arms and running down their backs feel like ice water. When men take a chill like that, they need a leader if they are to go on. And Deputy McGee led them. He got out in front and walked briskly, I bet he didn't feel very brisk right then, though, to a stand of alders that jutted out of the woods on the right, with the rest of them trundling along nervously about 5 paces behind. He paused just once, and that was to motion the biggest man among them, Sam Hollis, to keep near Klaus Dederick. On the other side of the alders, there was more open ground stretching back to the woods on the right. On the left was the long, gentle slope of the river bank. They all stopped where they were, thunderstruck. I think they would have given a good deal to unsee what was before them, and none of them would ever forget it. It was the sort of nightmare, bald and almost smoking in the sun, that lies beyond the drapes and furnishings of good and ordinary lives. Church suppers, walks along country lanes, honest work, love kisses in bed. There is a skull in every man, and I tell you there is a skull in the lives of all men. They saw it that day, those men. They saw what sometimes grins behind the smile. Sitting on the river bank, in a faded, blood-stained jumper, was the biggest man any of them had ever seen, John Coffey. His enormous, splay-toed feet were bare. On his head he wore a faded red bandana, the way a country woman would wear a kerchief into church. Gnats circled him in a black cloud. Curled in each arm was the body of a naked girl. Their blonde hair, once curly and light as milkweed fluff, was now matted to their heads and streaked red. The man holding them sat bawling up at the sky like a moonstruck calf, his dark brown cheek slicked with tears, his face twisted in a monstrous cramp of grief. He drew breath in hitches, his chest rising until the snaps holding the straps of his jumper were strained, and then let that vast catch of air out in another of those howls. So often you read in the paper that the killer showed no remorse, but that wasn't the case here. John Coffey was torn open by what he had done. But he would live. The girls would not. They had been torn open in a more fundamental way. No one seemed to know how long they stood there, looking at the howling man who was, in his turn, looking across the great still plate of the river at a train on the other side, storming down the tracks toward the trestle that crossed the river. It seemed they looked for an hour, or for forever, and yet the train got no farther along. It seemed to storm only in one place, like a child doing a tantrum, and the sun did not go behind a cloud, and the sight was not blotted from their eyes. It was there before them, as real as a dog bite. The black man rocked back and forth. Cora and Kathy rocked with him, like dolls in the arms of a giant. The blood-stained muscles in the man's huge, bare arms flexed and relaxed. It was Klaus Dederich who broke the tableau. Screaming, he flung himself at the monster who had raped and killed his daughters. Sam Hollis knew his job and tried to do it, but couldn't. He was 6 inches taller than Klaus and outweighed him by at least 70 pounds, but Klaus seemed to almost shrug his encircling arms off. Klaus flew across the intervening open ground and launched a flying kick at Coffey's head. His work boot, caked with spilled milk that had already soured in the heat, scored a direct hit on Coffey's left temple, but Coffey seemed not to feel it at all. He only sat there, keening and rocking and looking out across the river. The way I imagine it, he could almost have been a picture out of some Piney Woods Pentecostal sermon, the faithful follower of the cross looking out toward Goshen land. If not for the corpses, that was. It took 4 men to haul the hysterical farmer off John Coffey, and he fetched Coffey I don't know how many good licks before they finally did. It didn't seem to matter to Coffey, one way or the other. He just went on looking out across the river and keening. As for Dederich, all the fight went out of him when he was finally pulled off, as if some strange, galvanizing current had been running through the huge black man. I still have a tendency to think in electrical metaphors, you'll have to pardon me. And when Dederich's contact with that power source was finally broken, he went as limp as a man flung back from a live wire. He knelt wide-legged on the riverbank with his hands to his face, sobbing. Howie joined him, and they hugged each other forehead to forehead. 2 men watched them, while the rest formed a rifle-toting ring around the rocking, wailing black man. He still seemed not to realize that anyone but him was there. McGee stepped forward, shifted uncertainly from foot to foot for a bit, then hunkered. "Mister," he said in a quiet voice, and Coffey hushed at once. McGee looked at eyes that were bloodshot from crying. And still they streamed, as if someone had left a faucet on inside him. Those eyes wept, and yet were somehow untouched, distant and serene. I thought them the strangest eyes I had ever seen in my life, and McGee felt much the same. "Like the eyes of an animal that never saw a man before," he told one reporter just before the trial. "Mister, do you hear me?" McGee asked. Slowly, Coffey nodded his head. Still, he curled his arms around his unspeakable dolls, their chins down on their chests so their faces could not be clearly seen, one of the few mercies God saw fit to bestow that day. "Do you have a name?" McGee asked.
"John Coffey," he said in a thick and tear-clotted voice. "Coffee like the drink, only not spelled the same way."
McGee nodded, then pointed a thumb at the chest pocket of Coffee's jumper, which was bulging. It looked to McGee like it might have been a gun.
Not that a man Coffee's size would need a gun to do some major damage if he decided to go off. "What's that in there, John Coffee? Is that maybe a heater? A pistol?"
"No, sir," Coffee said in his thick voice, and those strange eyes, welling tears and agonized on top, distant and weirdly serene underneath, as if the true John Coffee was somewhere else, looking out on some other landscape where murdered little girls were nothing to get all worked up about, never left Deputy McGee's.
"That's just a little lunch I have."
"Oh, now, a little lunch, is that right?" McGee asked, and Coffee nodded and said yes, sir, with his eyes running and clear snot runners hanging out of his nose. "And where did the likes of you get a little lunch, John Coffee?" Forcing himself to be calm, although he could smell the girls by then and could see the flies lighting and sampling the places on them that were wet. "It was their hair that was the worst," he said later. And this wasn't in any newspaper story. It was considered too grisly for family reading. "No, this I got from the reporter who wrote the story. I looked him up later on, because later on, John Coffee became sort of an obsession with me. McGee told this reporter that their blonde hair wasn't blonde anymore. It was auburn. Blood had run down their cheeks out of it like it was a bad dye job, and you didn't have to be a doctor to see that their fragile skulls had been dashed together with the force of those mighty arms. Probably they had been crying. Probably he had wanted to make them stop. If the girls had been lucky, this had happened before the rapes. Looking at that made it hard for a man to think. Even a man as determined to do his job as Deputy McGee was. Bad thinking could cause mistakes, maybe more bloodshed. McGee drew him in a deep breath and calmed himself. Tried, anyway.
"Well, sir, I don't exactly remember. Be dog if I do," Coffee said in his tear-choked voice. "But it's a little lunch, all right. Sandwiches and I think a sweet pickle.
I might just have a look for myself if it's all the same to you," McGee said. "Don't you move now, John Coffee. Don't do it, boy, because there are enough guns aimed at you to make you disappear from the waist up should you so much as twitch a finger."
Coffee looked out across the river and didn't move as McGee gently reached into the chest pocket of those bibs and pulled out something wrapped in newspaper and tied with a hank of butcher's twine. McGee snapped the string and opened the paper, although he was pretty sure it was just what Coffee said it was, a little lunch. There was a bacon tomato sandwich and a jelly foldover. There was also a pickle, wrapped in its own piece of a funny page John Coffee would never be able to puzzle out. There were no sausages. Bowser had gotten the sausages out of John Coffee's little lunch. McGee handed the lunch back over his shoulder to one of the other men without taking his eyes off Coffee. Hunkered down like that, he was too close to want to let his attention stray for even a second. The lunch, wrapped up again and tied for good measure, finally ended up with Bobo Marchant, who put it in his knapsack where he kept treats for his dogs and a few fishing lures, I shouldn't wonder. It wasn't introduced into evidence at the trial. Justice in this part of the world is swift, but not as swift as a bacon-tomato sandwich goes over, though photographs of it were. "What happened here, John Coffee?" McGee asked in his low, earnest voice. "You want to tell me that?" And Coffee said to McGee and the others almost exactly the same thing he said to me. They were also the last words the prosecutor said to the jury at Coffee's trial.
"I couldn't help it,"
John Coffee said, holding the murdered, violated girls naked in his arms. The tears began to pour down his cheeks again.
"I tried to take it back, but it was too late."
"Boy, you are under arrest for murder," McGee said, and then he spit in John Coffee's face.
The jury was out 45 minutes. Just about time enough to eat a little lunch of their own.
I wonder they had any stomach for it. Chapter 5. I think you know I didn't find all that out during one hot October afternoon in the soon-to-be-defunct prison library from one set of old newspapers stacked in a pair of Pomona orange crates. But I learned enough to make it hard for me to sleep that night. When my wife got up at 2 a.m. and found me sitting in the kitchen drinking buttermilk and smoking home-rolled Bugler, she asked me what was wrong, and I lied to her, for one of the few times in the long course of our marriage. I said I'd had another run-in with Percy Wetmore. I had, of course, but that wasn't the reason she'd found me sitting up late. I was usually able to leave Percy at the office.
"Well, forget that rotten apple and come on back to bed," she said. "I've got something that'll help you sleep, and you can have all you want."
"That sounds good, but I think we better not," I said. "I've got a little something wrong with my waterworks, and I wouldn't want to pass it on to you." She raised an eyebrow.
"Waterworks, huh?" she said. "I guess you must have taken up with the wrong street corner girl last time you were in Baton Rouge."
I've never been in Baton Rouge and never so much as touched a street corner girl, and we both knew it. "It's just a plain old urinary infection," I said. "My mother used to say boys got 'em from taking a leak when the north wind was blowing."
"Your mother also used to stay in all day if she spilled the salt," my wife said.
"Dr. Sadler..." "No, sir," I said, raising my hand. "He'll want me to take sulfur, and I'll be throwing up in every corner of my office by the end of the week. It'll run its course. But in the meantime, I guess we best stay out of the playground." She kissed my forehead right over my left eyebrow, which always gives me the prickles, as Janice well knew.
"Poor baby. As if that awful Percy Wetmore wasn't enough. Come to bed soon."
I did, but before I did, I stepped out onto the back porch to empty out, and check the wind direction with a wet thumb before I did. What our parents tell us when we're small seldom goes ignored, no matter how foolish it may be. Peeing outdoors is one joy of country living the poets never quite got around to. But it was no joy that night. The water coming out of me burned like a line of lit coal oil. Yet I thought it had been a little worse that afternoon, and knew it had been worse the 2 or 3 days before. I had hopes that maybe I had started to mend. Never was a hope more ill-founded. No one had told me that sometimes a bug that gets up inside there where it's warm and wet can take a day or two off to rest before coming on strong again. I would have been surprised to know it. I would have been even more surprised to know that in another 15 or 20 years it would be pills you could take that would smack that sort of infection out of your system in record time. And while those pills might make you feel a little sick at your stomach or loose in your bowels, they almost never made you vomit the way Dr. Sadler's sulfa pills did. Back in 32, there wasn't much you could do but wait and try to ignore that feeling that someone had spilled coal oil inside your works and then touched a match to it. I finished my butt, went into the bedroom, and finally got to sleep. I dreamed of girls with shy smiles and blood in their hair. Chapter 6. The next morning there was a pink memo slip on my desk asking me to stop by the warden's office as soon as I could. I knew what that was about. There were unwritten but very important rules to the game, and I had stopped playing by them for a while yesterday, and so I put it off as long as possible. By going to the doctor about my waterworks problem, I suppose. I've always thought this get-it-over-with business was overrated. Anyway, I didn't hurry to Warden Moore's office. I stripped off my wool uniform coat instead, hung it over the back of my chair, and then turned on the fan in the corner. It was another hot one. Then I sat down and went over Brutus Howell's nightsheet. There was nothing there to get alarmed about. Delacroix had wept briefly after turning in. He did most nights, and more for himself than for the folks he had roasted alive, I'm quite sure, and then had taken Mr. Jingles, the mouse, out of the cigar box he slept in.
That had calmed Dell, and he had slept like a baby the rest of the night. Mr. Jingles had most likely spent it on Delacroix's stomach, with his tail curled over his paws, eyes unblinking. It was as if God had decided Delacroix needed a guardian angel, but had decided in his wisdom that only a mouse would do for a rat like our homicidal friend from Louisiana. Not all that was in Brutal's report, of course, but I had done enough night watches myself to fill in the stuff between the lines. There was a brief note about coffee. Laid awake, mostly quiet, may have cried some. I tried to get some talk started, but after a few grunted replies from coffee, gave up. Paul or Harry may have better luck. Getting the talk started was at the center of our job, really. I didn't know it then, but looking back from the vantage point of this strange old age, I think all old ages seem strange to the folk who must endure them, I understand that it was, and why I didn't see it then. It was too big, as central to our work as our respiration was to our lives. It wasn't important that the floaters be good at getting the talk started, but it was vital for me and Harry and Brutal and Dean, and it was one reason why Percy Wetmore was such a disaster. The inmates hated him, the guards hated him. Everyone hated him, presumably, except for his political connections, Percy himself, and maybe, but only maybe, his mother. He was like a dose of white arsenic sprinkled into a wedding cake, and I think I knew he spelled disaster from the start. He was an accident waiting to happen. As for the rest of us, we would have scoffed at the idea that we functioned most usefully not as the guards of the condemned, but as their psychiatrists. Part of me still wants to scoff at that idea today. But we knew about getting the talk started, and without the talk, men facing old Sparky had a nasty habit of going insane. I made a note at the bottom of Brutal's report to talk to John Coffey, to try at least, and then passed on to a note from Curtis Anderson, the warden's chief assistant. It said that he, Anderson, expected a DOE order for Edward Delacroix, Anderson's misspelling, the man's name was actually Edouard Delacroix, very soon. DOE stood for date of execution, and according to the note, Curtis had been told on good authority that the little Frenchman would take the walk shortly before Halloween. October 27th was his best guess, and Curtis Anderson's guesses were very informed. But before then, we could expect a new resident, name of William Wharton. "He's what you'd like to call a problem child," Curtis had written in his back-slanting and somehow prissy script. "Crazy wild and proud of it. Has rambled all over the state for the last year or so and has hit the big time at last. Killed 3 people in a hold-up, 1 a pregnant woman, killed a 4th in the getaway, state patrolman. All he missed was a nun and a blind man." I smiled a little at that. "Wharton is 19 years old, has Billy the Kid tattooed on upper left forearm. You will have to slap his nose a time or two, I guarantee you that, but be careful when you do it. This man just doesn't care." He had underlined this last sentiment twice, then finished, "Also, he may be a hang-arounder. He's working appeals, and there's the fact that he is a minor." A crazy kid, working appeals, apt to be around for a while. Oh, that all sounded just fine. Suddenly the day seemed hotter than ever, and I could no longer put off seeing Warden Moores. I worked for 3 wardens during my years as a Cold Mountain guard. Hal Moores was the last and best of them. In a walk, honest, straightforward, lacking even Curtis Anderson's rudimentary wit, but equipped with just enough political savvy to keep his job during those grim years, and enough integrity to keep from getting seduced by the game. He would not rise any higher, but that seemed all right with him. He was 58 or 59 back then, with a deeply lined bloodhound face that Bobo Marshaw probably would have felt right at home with. He had white hair, and his hand shook with some sort of palsy, but he was strong. The year before, when a prisoner had rushed him in the exercise yard with a shank whittled out of a crate slat, Moores had stood his ground, grabbed the skatehound's wrist, and had twisted it so hard that the snapping bones had sounded like dry twigs burning in a hot fire. The skate hound, all his grievances forgotten, had gone down on his knees in the dirt and began screaming for his mother. "I'm not her," Moores said in his cultured southern voice, "but if I was, I'd raise up my skirts and piss on you from the loins that gave you birth." When I came into his office, he started to get up, and I waved him back down. I took the seat across the desk from him and began by asking about his wife, except in our part of the world, that's not how you do it. "How's that pretty gal of yours?" is what I asked, as if Melinda had seen only 17 summers instead of 62 or 3. My concern was genuine. She was a woman I could have loved and married myself, if the lines of our lives had coincided. But I didn't mind diverting him a little from his main business, either. He sighed deeply. "Not so well, Pa. Not so well at all." "More headaches?" "Only one this week, but it was the worst yet. Put her flat on her back for most of the day before yesterday. And now she's developed this weakness in her right hand." He raised his own liver-spotted right hand. We both watched it tremble above his blotter for a moment or two, and then he lowered it again. I could tell he would have given just about anything not to be telling me what he was telling me, and I would have given just about anything not to be hearing it. Melinda's headaches had started in the spring, and all that summer her doctor had been saying they were nervous tension migraines, perhaps caused by the stress of Hal's coming retirement. Except that neither of them could wait for his retirement, and my own wife had told me that migraine is not a disease of the old, but the young. By the time its sufferers reached Melinda Moores's age, they were usually getting better, not worse. And now this weakness of the hand. It didn't sound like nervous tension to me, it sounded like a damned stroke. "Dr. Haverstrom wants her to go in hospital up to Indianola," Moores said. "Have some tests. Head x-rays, he means. Who knows what else? She is scared to death." He paused, then added, "Truth to tell, so am I." "Yeah, but you see she does it," I said. "Don't wait. If it turns out to be something they can see with an x-ray, it may turn out to be something they can fix." "Yes," he agreed. And then, for just a moment, the only one during that part of our interview, as I recall, our eyes met and locked. There was the sort of nakedly perfect understanding between us that needs no words. It could be a stroke, yes. It could also be a cancer growing in her brain, and if it was that, the chances that the doctors at Indianola could do anything about it were slim going on none. This was 32, remember, when even something as relatively simple as a urinary infection was either sulfur and stink or suffer and wait. "I thank you for your concern, Paul. Now let's talk about Percy Wetmore." I groaned and covered my eyes. "I had a call from the state capitol this morning," the warden said evenly. "It was quite an angry call, as I'm sure you can imagine. Paul, the governor is so married, he's almost not there, if you take my meaning, and his wife has a brother who has one child. That child is Percy Wetmore. Percy called his dad last night, and Percy's dad called Percy's aunt. Do I have to trace the rest of this out for you?" "No," I said. Percy squealed. Just like the schoolroom sissy telling teacher he saw Jack and Jill smooching in the cloakroom. "Yep," Moores agreed. "That's about the size of it. You know what happened between Percy and Delacroix when Delacroix came in?" I asked. "Percy and his damned hickory billy club?" "Yes, but, and you know how he runs along the bars sometimes just for the pure hell of it? He's mean and he's stupid, and I don't know how much longer I can take him, that's the truth." We'd known each other 5 years. That can be a long time for men who get on well, especially when part of the job is trading life for death. What I'm saying is that he understood what I meant. Not that I would quit. Not with a depression walking around outside the prison walls like a dangerous criminal, one that couldn't be caged as our charges were.
Better men than me were out on the roads or riding the rods. I was lucky and knew it. Children grown, and the mortgage, that 200-pound block of marble, had been off my chest for the last 2 years. But a man's got to eat, and his wife has to eat, too. Also, we were used to sending our daughter and son-in-law $20 whenever we could afford it, and sometimes when we couldn't, if Jane's letter sounded particularly desperate. He was an out-of-work high school teacher, and if that didn't qualify for desperate back in those days, then the word had no meaning. So, no, you didn't walk off a steady paycheck job like mine. Not in cold blood, that was. But my blood wasn't cold that fall. The temperatures outside were unseasonable, and the infection crawling around inside me had turned the thermostat up even more. And when a man's in that kind of situation, why, sometimes his fist flies out pretty much of its own accord. And if you slug a connected man like Percy Wetmore once, you might as well just go right on slugging, because there's no going back. "Stick with it," Moore said quietly. "That's what I called you in here to say. I have it on good authority, the person who called me this morning, in fact, that Percy has an application in at Briar, and that his application will be accepted." "Briar?" I said. "That was Briar Ridge, one of two state-run hospitals. What's this kid doing? Touring state facilities? It's an administration job. Better pay and papers to push instead of hospital beds in the heat of the day." He gave me a slanted grin. "You know, Paul, you might be shed of him already, if you hadn't put him in the switch room with Van Hay when the chief walked." For a moment, what he said seemed so peculiar, I didn't have a clue what he was getting at. Maybe I didn't want to have a clue. "Where else would I put him?" I asked. "Christ, he hardly knows what he's doing on the block. To make him part of the active execution team..." I didn't finish. Couldn't finish. The potential for screw-up seemed endless. "Nevertheless, you'd do well to put him on for Delacroix. If you want to get rid of him, that is." I looked at him with my jaw hung. At last I was able to get it up where it belonged so I could talk. "What are you saying? That he wants to experience one right up close where he can smell the guy's nuts cooking?" Moore shrugged. His eyes, so soft when he had been speaking about his wife, now looked flinty. "Delacroix's nuts are going to cook whether Wetmore's on the team or not," he said. "Correct?" "Yes, but he could screw up. In fact, Hal, he's almost bound to screw up, and in front of 30 or so witnesses, reporters all the way up from Louisiana." "You and Brutus Howell will make sure he doesn't," Moore said. "And if he does, anyway, it goes on his record, and it'll still be there long after his statehouse connections are gone. You understand?" I did. It made me feel sick and scared, but I did. "He may want to stay for coffee, but if we're lucky, he'll get all he needs from Delacroix. You just make sure you put him out for that one." I had planned to stick Percy in the switch room again, then down in the tunnel, riding shotgun on the gurney that would take Delacroix to the meat wagon across the road from the prison, but I tossed all those plans back over my shoulder without so much as a second look. I nodded. I had the sense to know it was a gamble I was taking, but I didn't care. If it would get rid of Percy Wetmore, I'd tweak the devil's nose. He could take part in his execution, clamp on the cap and then look through the grill and tell Van Hay to roll on too. He could watch the little Frenchman ride the lightning that he, Percy Wetmore, had let out of the bottle. Let him have his nasty little thrill, if that's what state-sanctioned murder was to him. Let him go on to Briar Ridge, where he would have his own office and a fan to cool it. And if his uncle by marriage was voted out of office in the next election, and he had to find out what work was like in the tough old sun-baked world, where not all the bad guys were locked behind bars, and sometimes you got your own head whipped, so much the better. "All right," I said, standing up. "I'll put him out front for Delacroix. And in the meantime, I'll keep the peace.
Good, he said, and stood up himself. By the way, how's that little problem of yours?
He pointed delicately in the direction of my groin.
Seems a little better.
Well, that's fine.
He saw me to the door.
What about coffee, by the way? Is he going to be a problem?
I don't think so, I said. So far, he's been as quiet as a dead rooster.
He's strange. Strange eyes. But quiet.
We'll keep tabs on him, though. Don't worry about that.
You know what he did, of course.
Sure. He was seeing me through to the outer office by then, where old Miss Hannah sat, bashing away at her Underwood as she had ever since the last ice age had ended, it seemed. I was happy to go. All in all, I felt as if I'd gotten off easy. And it was nice to know there was a chance of surviving Percy after all.
You send Melinda a whole basket of my love, I said. And don't go buying you an extra crate of trouble, either. It'll probably turn out to be nothing but migraine after all.
You bet, he said, and below his sick eyes his lips smiled. The combination was damn near ghoulish. As for me, I went back to E Block to start another day. There was paperwork to be read and written, there were floors to be mopped, there were meals to be served, a duty roster to be made out for the following week, there were 100 details to be seen to. But mostly there was waiting. In prison there's always plenty of that. So much it never gets done. Waiting for Edouard Delacroix to walk the Green Mile, waiting for William Wharton to arrive with his curled lip and Billy the Kid tattoo, and most of all, waiting for Percy Wetmore to be gone out of my life.
Chapter 7 Delacroix's mouse was one of God's mysteries. I never saw one in E Block before that summer, and never saw one after that fall, when Delacroix passed from our company on a hot and thundery night in October. Passed from it in a manner so unspeakable, I can barely bring myself to recall it. Delacroix claimed that he trained that mouse, which started its life among us as Steamboat Willie, but I really think it was the other way around. Dean Stanton felt the same way, and so did Brutal. Both of them were there the night the mouse put in its first appearance, and as Brutal said, "The thing is half-tame already, and twice as smart as that Cajun what thought he owned it." Dean and I were in my office going over the record box for the last year, getting ready to write follow-up letters to witnesses of 5 executions, and to write follow-ups to follow-ups in another 6, stretching all the way back to 29. Basically, we wanted to know just one thing. Were they pleased with the service? I know it sounds grotesque, but it was an important consideration. As taxpayers, they were our customers, but very special ones. A man or a woman who will turn out at midnight to watch a man die has got a special, pressing reason to be there, a special need. And if execution is a proper punishment, then that need ought to be satisfied. They've had a nightmare. The purpose of the execution is to show them that the nightmare is over. Maybe it even works that way. Sometimes. Hey! Brutal called from outside the door where he was manning the desk at the head of the hall. Hey, you two, get out here! Dean and I gazed at each other with identical expressions of alarm, thinking that something had happened to either the Indian from Oklahoma, his name was Arlen Bitterbuck, but we called him the Chief, or in Harry Terwilliger's case, Chief Goat Cheese, because that was what Harry claimed Bitterbuck smelled like, or the fellow we called the President. But then Brutal started to laugh, and we hurried to see what was happening. Laughing in E Block sounded almost as wrong as laughing in church. Old Toot Toot, the trustee who ran the food wagon in those days, had been by with his holy rolling cart full of goodies, and Brutal had stocked up for a long night. 3 sandwiches, 2 pops, and a couple of moon pies. Also a side of potato salad Toot had undoubtedly filched from the prison kitchen, which was supposed to be off limits to him. Brutal had the logbook open in front of him, and for a wonder he hadn't spilled anything on it yet. Of course, he was just getting started.
What? Dean asked. What is it?
State legislature must open the purse strings enough to hire another screw this year after all, Brutal said, still laughing. Looky yonder.
He pointed, and we saw the mouse. I started to laugh, too, and Dean joined in. You really couldn't help it, because a guard doing quarter-hour check rounds was just like that mouse looked like, a tiny, furry guard making sure no one was trying to escape or commit suicide. It would trot a little way toward us along the green mile, then turn its head from side to side, as if checking the cells. Then it would make another forward spurt. The fact that we could hear both of our current inmates snoring away, in spite of the yelling and the laughter, somehow made it even funnier. It was a perfectly ordinary brown mouse, except for the way it seemed to be checking into the cells. It even went into one or two of them, skipping nimbly in between the lower bars, in a way I imagine many of our inmates, past and present, would envy. Except it was out that the cons would always be wanting to skip, of course. The mouse didn't go into either of the occupied cells, only the empties. And finally it had worked its way almost up to where we were. I kept expecting it to turn back, but it didn't. It showed no fear of us at all. It ain't normal for a mouse to come up on people that way, Dean said a little nervously. Maybe it's rabid.
Oh, my Christ, Brutal said through a mouthful of corned beef sandwich. The big mouse expert, the mouse man. You see it foaming at the mouth, mouse man?
I can't see its mouth at all, Dean said, and that made us all laugh again.
I couldn't see its mouth either, but I could see the dark little drops that were its eyes, and they didn't look crazy or rabid to me. They looked interested and intelligent. I put men to death, men with supposedly immortal souls that looked dumber than that mouse. It scurried up the green mile to a spot that was less than 3 feet from the duty desk, which wasn't something fancy like you might be imagining, but only the sort of desk the teachers used to sit behind up at the district high school. And there it did stop, curling its tail around its paws as prim as an old lady settling her skirts. I stopped laughing all at once, suddenly feeling cold through my flesh all the way to the bones. I want to say I don't know why I felt that way. No one likes to come out with something that's going to make them look or sound ridiculous. But of course I do. And if I can tell the truth about the rest, I guess I can tell the truth about this. For a moment, I imagined myself to be that mouse. Not a guard at all, but just another convicted criminal there on the green mile, convicted and condemned, but still managing to look bravely up at a desk that must have seen miles high to it, as the judgment seat of God will no doubt someday seem to us, and at the heavy-voiced, blue-coated giants who sat behind it. Giants that shot its kind with BB guns, or swatted them with brooms, or set traps on them, traps that broke their backs while they crept cautiously over the word victor to nibble at the cheese on the little copper plate. There was no broom by the duty desk, but there was a rolling mop bucket with the mop still in the wringer. I'd taken my turn at swabbing the green lino and all six of the cells shortly before sitting down to the record box with Dean. I saw that Dean meant to grab the mop and take a swing with it. I touched his wrist, just as his fingers touched the slender wooden handle. "Leave it be," I said. He shrugged and drew his hand back. I had a feeling he didn't want to swat it any more than I did. Brutal tore a corner off his corned beef sandwich and held it out over the front of the desk, tweezed delicately between two fingers. The mouse seemed to look up with an even livelier interest, as if it knew exactly what it was. Probably did. I could see its whiskers twitch as its nose wriggled.
"Oh, Brutal, no!" Dean exclaimed, then looked at me. "Don't let him do that, Paul. If he's going to feed the damn thing, we might as well put out the welcome mat for anything on four legs."
"I just want to see what he'll do," Brutal said, "in the interest of science, like."
He looked at me. I was the boss, even in such minor detours from routine as this. I thought about it and shrugged like it didn't matter much one way or another. The truth was, I kind of wanted to see what he'd do, too. Well, he ate it, of course. There was a depression on, after all. But the way he ate it fascinated us all. He approached the fragment of sandwich, sniffed his way around it, and then he sat up in front of it like a dog doing a trick, grabbed it, and pulled the bread apart to get at the meat. He did it as deliberately and knowingly as a man tucking into a good roast beef dinner in his favorite restaurant. I never saw an animal eat like that, not even a well-trained house dog. And all the while he was eating, his eyes never left us.
"Either one smart mouse or hungry as hell," a new voice said.
It was Bitterbuck. He had awakened and now stood at the bars of his cell, naked except for a pair of saggy seated boxer shorts. A home-rolled cigarette poked out from between the second and third knuckles of his right hand, and his iron-gray hair lay over his shoulders, once probably muscular but now beginning to soften, in a pair of braids.
"You got any injun wisdom about mices, Chief?"
Brutal asked, watching the mouse eat. We were all pretty fetched by the neat way it held the bit of corned beef in its forepaws, occasionally churning it or glancing at it as if in admiration and appreciation.
"No," Bitterbuck said. "No, the brave once had a pair of what he claimed were mouse-skin gloves, but I didn't believe it."
Then he laughed as if the whole thing was a joke and left the bars. We heard the bunk creak as he lay down again. That seemed to be the mouse's signal to go. It finished up what it was holding, sniffed at what was left, mostly bread with yellow mustard soaking into it, and then looked back at us as if it wanted to remember our faces if we met again. Then it turned and scurried off the way it had come, not pausing to do any cell checks this time. Its hurry made me think of the white rabbit in Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, and I smiled. It didn't pause at the door to the restraint room, but disappeared beneath it. The restraint room had soft walls for people whose brains had softened a little. We kept cleaning equipment stored in there when we didn't need the room for its created purpose, and a few books. Most were westerns by Clarence Mulford, but one, loaned out only on special occasions, featured a profusely illustrated tale in which Popeye, Bluto, and even Wimpy, the hamburger fiend, took turns stooping olive oil. There were craft items as well, including the crayons Delacroix later put to some good use. Not that he was our problem yet, this was earlier, remember. Also in the restraint room was the jacket no one wanted to wear, white, made of double-sewn canvas, and with the buttons and snaps and buckles going up the back. We all knew how to zip a problem child into that jacket lickety-larrup. They didn't get violent often, our lost boys. But when they did, brother, you didn't wait around for the situation to improve on its own. Brutal reached into the desk drawer above the knee hole and brought out the big leather-bound book with the word Visitors stamped on the front in gold leaf. Ordinarily, that book stayed in the drawer from one month to the next. When a prisoner had visitors, unless it was a lawyer or a minister, he went over to the room off the mess hall that was kept special for that purpose. The arcade, we called it, I don't know why.
"Just what in the gore do you think you're doing?"
Dean Stanton asked, peering over the tops of his spectacles as Brutal opened the book and paged grandly past years of visitors to men now dead.
"Obeying Regulation 19, Brutal said, finding the current page.
He took the pencil and licked the tip, a disagreeable habit of which he could not be broken, and prepared to write. Regulation 19 stated simply, "Each visitor to E-Block shall show a yellow administration pass and shall be recorded without fail."
"He's gone nuts," Dean said to me.
"He didn't show us his pass, but I'm gonna let it go this time," Brutal said.
He gave the tip of his pencil an extra lick for good luck, then filled in 9:49 p.m. under the column headed Time on Block.
"Sure, why not? The big bosses probably make exceptions for mice,"
I said. "Of course they do," Brutal agreed. "Lack of pockets." He turned to look at the wall clock behind the desk, then printed 10:01 in the column-headed time off block. The longer space between these two numbers was headed name of visitor. After a moment's hard thought, probably to muster his limited spelling skills, as I'm sure the idea was in his head already, Brutus Howell carefully wrote Steamboat Willie, which was what most people called Mickey Mouse back in those days. It was because of that first talkie cartoon where he rolled his eyes and bumped his hips around and pulled the whistle cord in the pilot house of the steamboat. "There," Brutal said, slamming the book closed and returning it to its drawer, "all done and buttoned up." I laughed, but Dean, who couldn't help being serious about things even when he saw the joke, was frowning and polishing his glasses furiously. "He'll be in trouble if someone sees that." He hesitated and added, "The wrong someone." He hesitated again, looking nearsightedly around, almost as if he expected to see that the walls had grown ears before finishing, "Someone like Percy kiss my ass and go to heaven Wetmore." "Huh," Brutal said. "The day Percy Wetmore sits his narrow shanks down here at this desk will be the day I resign." "You won't have to," Dean said. "They'll fire you for making jokes in the visitor's book if Percy puts the right word in the right ear, and he can. You know he can." Brutal glowered, but said nothing. I reckoned that later on that night he would erase what he had written. And if he didn't, I would. The next night, after getting first Bitterbuck and then the president over to D-Block, where we showered our group after the regular cons were locked down, Brutal asked me if we shouldn't have a look for Steamboat Willie down there in the restraint room. "I guess we ought to," I said. We'd had a good laugh over that mouse the night before, but I knew that if Brutal and I found it down there in the restraint room, particularly if we found it had gnawed itself the beginnings of a nest in one of the padded walls, we would kill it. Better to kill the scout, no matter how amusing it might be, than have to live with the pilgrims. And I shouldn't have to tell you neither of us was very squeamish about a little mouse murder. Killing rats was what the state paid us for, after all. But we didn't find Steamboat Willie, later to be known as Mr. Jingles, that night, not nested in the soft walls or behind any of the collected junk we hauled out into the corridor. There was a great deal of junk, too, more than I would have expected, because we hadn't had to use the restraint room in a long time. That would change with the advent of William Wharton, but of course we didn't know that at the time. Lucky us. "Where'd it go?" Brutal asked at last, wiping sweat off the back of his neck with a big blue bandana. "No hole, no crack, there's that, but..." He pointed to the drain in the floor. Below the grate, which the mouse could have gotten through, was a fine steel mesh that not even a fly would have passed. "How'd it get in? How'd it get out?" "I don't know," I said. "He did come in here, didn't he? I mean, the three of us saw him." "Yep, right under the door. He had to squeeze a little, but he made it." "Gosh," Brutal said, a word that sounded strange coming from a man that big. "It's a good thing the cons can't make themselves small like that, isn't it?" "You bet," I said, running my eye over the canvas walls one last time, looking for a hole, a crack, anything. There was nothing. "Come on, let's go." Steamboat Willie showed up again 3 nights later, when Harry Terwilliger was on the duty desk. Percy was also on and chased the mouse back down the green mile with the same mop Dean had been thinking of using. The rodent avoided Percy easily, slipping through the crack beneath the restraint room door, a hands-down winner. Cursing at the top of his voice, Percy unlocked the door and hauled all that shit out again. It was funny and scary at the same time, Harry said. Percy was vowing he'd catch the goddamn mouse and tear its diseased little head right off. But he didn't, of course. Sweaty and disheveled, the shirt tail of his uniform hanging out in the back, he returned to the duty desk half an hour later, brushing his hair out of his eyes and telling Harry, who had sat serenely reading through most of the ruckus, that he was going to put a strip of insulation on the bottom of the door down there. That would solve the vermin problem, he declared.
"Whatever you think is best, Percy,"
Harry said, turning a page of the Ode Opera he was reading. He thought Percy would forget about blocking the crack at the bottom of that door, and he was right. Chapter 8. Late that winter, long after these events were over, Brutal came to me one night when it was just the two of us, E-block temporarily empty, and all the other